Investors Chronicle.
Welcome back to the Companies and Market Show, Thursday the 16th of June, as we record, joined in the studio by Mitchell Labiak. Welcome back, Mitch.
Hi, good to be back.
Everyone's favourite colleague at the moment, because he brought in baked goods yesterday.
I thought you were going to say because of my journalism, but no.
No, because of the food.
Yeah, of course, yeah, I should know.
Very, very nice cookies.
Oh, thanks very much. I didn't make them, but I'll take the credit anyway.
Who did?
My wife.
Oh. Yeah. Well, shout out to her then.
Yeah, will do. Yeah, if she's listening.
Alex Newman, hi Alex.
Hi John, how are you?
Good, thank you. And welcome back to Dan Jones, back from his holidays.
Hi, good to be back.
Good to have you back. Alex did try to take over permanently last week, but...
Yeah, I did hear.
Yeah, it was a coup.
A failed coup. Dan, what are we going to be discussing today?
So yeah, we've got a few things this week. A cover story, we're going to be speaking to Julian separately later on about shares for safety, the idea of building in a safety margin to the companies and stocks that you buy, which obviously is pretty important at the moment. Other than that, we've got our result of the week, which is Crest Nicholson and a few interesting things going on there. And from that, inevitably, perhaps we're going to lead on to a bit of a conversation about the housing market in general. It's always an interesting topic for everyone, I think. Certainly everyone in the UK is a classic, chattering classes topic, if we can describe ourselves that way.
Yeah, we are the chattering class.
Yeah,
the
by podcast. Definition.
Yeah.
Lovely stuff. Well, before we get there, here's what's happened so far this week. Plenty more tightening action from central banks globally as they continue to attempt to tackle rampant inflation. Wednesday, we had news that the US Fed made their first 75 basis point rise since 1994, while the European Central Bank announced an end to bond purchases. The Bank of England sits a little later on, or potentially right now, as we record, but they're also expected to put up a rates rise. You'll know what they've done, listener, more than we will. Elsewhere, the cryptocurrency industry continued to hemorrhage this week. Bitcoin touching fresh lows for the year. It's hovering above £17,000 at the time of recording, having dumped 70% of its value since last autumn's peak. Some selected companies news. ASOS today lowered its full-year profit guidance after the fast fashion giant said inflationary pressure was increasingly impacting our customers' shopping behaviour. With rising return rates and faltering sales growth. Shares fell 25%. BP signed on to one of its most ambitious green industrial projects yet, taking a 40% stake in a massive hydrogen generation facility in Australia. The project's cost is an estimated £30 billion, with a final investment decision expected by 2025. WH Smith is reaping the rewards of the travel sector's recovery. In an update, they noted particularly strong sales at its airports and railway station shops. Sales are at 107% of pre-pandemic levels over the same period. Shares rose 7%. And sports betting company Entain has entered into an agreement to acquire a key competitor in the Netherlands. The company will pick up the entire share capital of BetCity for an initial £257 million. The boards of both Capital & Counties and Shaftesbury have waved through a merger between the two companies. The merger, which still requires the approval of shareholders and regulators, would create a £3 billion landlord, which would own almost 3 million square feet of West End real estate. Another reminder to subscribe to our daily trader email for all these updates and more, delivered for free into your inbox. Link to that in the show notes. Finally for today, back to the markets. Wall Street officially fell into bear market territory with a 4% loss on Monday, moving the S&P 500 21% below its January peak. FTSE 100 is down 5% since last Friday as well. Those accurate at the time of recording, of course. Over to you, Dan.
Thanks, John. Yeah, so we are turning to our result of the week, which is Crest Nicholson. Mitchell, you wrote, analysed these results for us. Seemed like a fairly decent set of results, but despite the headline figures being a little, on the negative side.
Yeah, it's a funny one. It's a £50 million loss, but that comes with a large asterisk, not just one which Crest Nicholson would like you to know, but also a quite a fair one. They confirmed on their balance sheet for this result that they're going to pay £105 million towards cladding costs. So you take that out of the equation, the profit then looks sort of in line with last year's profits when they only were paying 10 million towards cladding costs. So revenue is good, revenue's on the up, but I suppose the looming question is whether there's going to be sort of more cladding costs, considering that's what hit their bottom line this time around.
Yeah, I should say these are obviously half-year results for the first half. Yeah, we'll come on to I suppose, the outlook for the sector and the market in general in a minute. But yeah, just to talk about cladding a bit more, I suppose it's, you know, we had the government, you know, leaning a little harder on the sector a couple of months ago. We've seen a lot of provisions being raised. In response to that, I think Crest said, management said they believe they're over the bulk of those costs now. But as management would always say such things, I suppose there's still perhaps some lingering uncertainties as to, you know, whether these costs may increase again in future. You know, the government may want to raise some more money for repairs, that kind of thing. So there's a question mark there, isn't there?
Yeah, it's exactly that. I suppose what it comes down to is how much you think Crest Nicholson knows or how much you want to take them at their word. Because, of course, they said in April that this new... Because they've already put 47 million towards cladding or cladding remediation. And they said in, I believe it was April, but they said they would estimate they'd need to put in another 80 to 120 million. They've now put in 105. So that's pretty much bang on what they said. But then, of course, as you were saying, it's sort of, this is largely dependent on the government, because they could change the threshold for what, you know, what sort of cladding they want remediated. There are also other fire safety concerns in buildings, which they may need to sort of deal with as well. There's waking watch. There's a lot of things that the government could ask house builders to do, and much more ways they could raise money from them, considering they're not, I believe they want to raise something in the region of 4 to 5 billion, and they've currently raised about 2. So the government could yet ask house builders to cough up more. And I think Crest Nicholson might well, despite what they say, they could well be aware of this. They've got 170 million in net cash in their coffers at the moment. Now, that could be for a variety of reasons, but it could also be arguably a sensible sort of sitting on that cash just in case the government want more money from them. So it's a, yeah, it's an interesting one.
Another thing you raised in your write-up was, you know, the possibility flagged by some analysts, as is sometimes the case, of, you know, private equity getting involved, which, you know, is a possibility for almost every UK company, it seems, yeah, at the moment. But I'm sure that helped with sentiment as well.
Yeah, it's been a really interesting one. So funnily enough, at the time I wrote the results, I you know, the share price went up 10%. But the share price now is now more or less back down to where it was. So I think there is just I'm not going to try and guess the minds of shareholders and stock pickers, but I think there was a sort of idea that, oh, this company could well be taken up by private equity. It's currently trading at a 29%, I believe it is, something like that. Yeah, 29% discount to tangible net asset value. That was a stat calculated by Peel Hunt at the time. They calculated it as one of the biggest, if not the biggest, discount among the major house builders. So it certainly seems like it could be a private equity target. But of course, that's far from any sort of guarantee. And I think private equity takeover has been hard to guess at the moment. It's not always about discount to NAV. It's about whatever private equity feels like buying that day, to be honest. So I wouldn't go as far as to say that it'd be a silly assumption to make. But it's also, it's far from a guarantee. It's a long way off if it does happen.
Alex, what do you think about the sector in general at the moment? Its fortunes, its prospects.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose the other thing to factor into the costs which are still going to come out of the profits of house builders in the next couple of years is the developers' levy, which is a proportion of their profits above 25 million. So I guess Crest Nicholson's results, half-year results, given that the levy only came in at the beginning of April, don't really cross over with that period. So that's something that investors have factor in over the coming few years. But as to the prospects for the sector, the comments they've been making this past results season are generally to the effect that they are handling cost inflation, even though it seems, you know, it's obviously a concern. And the builders which are focused in the areas of the country where demand is the strongest, which it seems to be the bulk of them now, not many are focused in places like London where you've got real concern about the outlook for house prices and planning legislation, that they kind of have a decent view ahead of them about as to the returns on equity that they can make. obviously there's a considerable amount of caution which might prevent some of these bids, but, you know, interesting to see some of the speculation around tie-ups within the industry. I mean, these shares are, they're quite staggeringly cheap at the moment, and they're not cheap falling knife typical stocks where there are real looming problems with their balance sheets ahead. Crest Nicholson's got £170 million in cash as the half-year point. And so they're being cautious in additional remediation they might need to make. But that's not a company in distress. That's a company which is trading against forecasts of 38p adjusted EPS. It's on 7x forward earnings. I don't know. My feeling has been that the sector's been kind of at the bottom, but I've been saying that for a few months, and it is found a fresh bottom with every passing month. So what do I know? They do look ridiculously cheap, and they're all screening on the stock screens we run each week as among the cheapest shares. So
I suppose there was a sign of Crest, backing up that belief in its results as well, because it did, despite concerns about the economy and perhaps the housing market, which we'll come to in a second, they did raise their guidance for the full year as well, which is, a creditable achievement given the current backdrop. I'm sure that helped with the results today, lifting the share price as well. But on which note, we should, turn to the housing market and the UK market and its prospective fortunes. Obviously, the Bank of England is continuing to raise rates, as most central banks are this week. You can look at a number of metrics in terms of the usual ones in terms of affordability, but increasingly now in terms of mortgage affordability. Arrears are rising. I think I saw yesterday, the arrears are at the highest level for a decade, if not slightly longer. Admittedly, these are very low levels of arrears. There's nervousness, obviously, about the UK economy. Mitchell, you wrote a piece this week about the housing market and how things might affect it.
Yes, I did. So, that on that arrears point, when you said you read it somewhere, you might well have read it in my piece, or maybe you read it somewhere else as well. I'm not the only person to be making these points, but there's some data from Savills that forecasts that mortgage payments as a percentage of incomes are risen to 24% at the end of 2022. So essentially their mortgages are the most expensive they've been relative to earnings since 2010, which would then explain why mortgage arrears are also at the highest level they've been since 2010. And Savills were keen to caveat this with, we're still way off levels of 2007, 2008 credit crunch levels, or the 1980s and 1990s. But then, of course, Savills would say that, wouldn't they? But no, they are, of course, way off. But it is notable that it's the highest it's been since 2010. And it's also the first year since about 2012 that we might see a fall in house price growth, i.e. a fall in house prices. Once again, that's according to Savills. So, to put this into context, though, this would be a 1% fall in house prices. And Savills, were their original forecast for this year was more conservative than the actual house price growth we're seeing. So should caveat that. So in other words, they've been wrong before when they've claimed that the housing market will slow down. But they are once again claiming the housing market will slow down. So it's a tough one to guess. Yeah. But the signs seem to point to, if not a fall in house prices, then at least less growth in house prices.
I think the thing that underpins these discussions in the UK and the question of what house prices obviously have risen so far in for such an extended period, a long-term view certainly, and there's a large group of people waiting, it seems, for that to change, or wondering if that will ever change. And you're getting some conditions now, albeit rates still only 1.25%, not very high, but you are getting tighter conditions. But the other factor which always provides the ballast is the sheer lack of supply of housing, which really does put a floor under the market and means this situation we're in now, even if things get a bit tighter, it's hard, famous last words perhaps, but it's hard to see a lot of forced selling, and therefore, and the lack of supply means falls, if they do materialise, should be quite minimal. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, it's always a difficult one to guess. I mean, supply and demand, it seems to be this constant, you almost sound like a bit of a parrot saying that there's supply and demand imbalance in house building, but it is a large thing that's sort of keeping costs up. The government obviously wants to try and address that, but it's been trying to address that for years. And the Help to Buy, I think they hoped that the Help to Buy scheme would address this by allowing people to buy more homes. But really that just sort of, I mean, there's a lot of criticism of it, but the main one is that it ended up just artificially inflating the cost of houses. So unless the government begins to embark on a massive house building program, then we're going to end up with this supply and demand imbalance, arguably, for some time to come.
I think you're certainly seeing it around, again, to use our anecdotal evidence, but, you know, in London at the moment, the, you know, I'm not looking to buy, but I know a couple of people who are, you know, buying or selling, as everyone tends to at any given moment. But the
I should say I have a vested interest because I'm currently trying to buy.
Well, you will know as well as anyone. Then so. The number of properties on the market is incredibly low, it seems, at the moment. Alex, how do you see the state of the housing market?
Well, I can also start to have a vested interest because I'm trying to sell a flat at the moment.
You two could work together.
Yeah, I was about to say, you're selling in Croydon.
I'm afraid it's simple. It's available in Peckham if you want a two-bed flat in Peckham. Yeah, so I have a vested interest in house prices staying unsustainably elevated. it's a very interesting one, price movements aside. I mean, the chart that Mitchell's put in his piece, really interesting, a combination of the enormous house price growth we've seen over the last decade, but also some of the forecasts that Savills have made. I suppose one thing that jumps out of that is that if we add in inflation, house prices are already falling. That sort of cuts both ways, because in terms of mortgage affordability, and we don't want to downplay how unaffordable housing costs are for so many people, but it's a consideration, isn't it? If inflation is going to be rising, that's also eating away at the value of the nominal value of mortgages, and lots of people are on fixed rate mortgages, actually, you know, not having a terrible time of it. Could that therefore underpin prices a bit more? Yeah, hard to say. It remains, I suppose, the most important thing, which we can't overlook, both from an investor perspective, but broadly, is just that supply-demand fundamentals. We can talk about prices all the time, but it does come back to the housing people want, the housing that's being supplied, and there's a huge mismatch there, and that's not going away for the next few years, at least.
I think it seems to me, you're relatively positive on the house building sector, and maybe, you know, there is this macro overhang of people worrying again about, you know, what's going on with the economy and therefore demand for housing, that could be affected as well. But, you know, maybe the bigger implications are going to be for, you know, people involved in the flow of housing transactions, you know, whether that be, you know, the estate agents or whether it be, you know, even things like home improvements, things like that, you know, okay, on one hand, people staying put, but on the other hand, obviously, we've had a huge boom in that market over the past couple of years, which is starting to unwind as well. So
it's interesting that Mitchell in the piece also mentions the latest survey from Ricks about the sudden drop in new buyer inquiries. I wonder if there's a kind of fatigue setting in the industry a little bit, because you've got lots of people who've been chasing the idea of moving onto the property ladder or moving up the property ladder, and for the last year and a half, and some of those people just haven't managed to do that, and at a certain point, with economic conditions looking bleaker ahead, people may be settling with their current situation. I don't know. It's an interesting signal. It's hard to say exactly what it is signalling, but if that is sustained, then that could mean that demand is actually pulling back sharply. So
it's a really difficult one to predict. I mean, It's the nature of the beast, the housing market. You've got so many different interests, arguably conflicting interests, because of course it's in house builders' interests to keep supply low, because they don't want to flood the market with lots of housing, because that will affect their bottom line. Of course, that's not always within their control, because their competitors might end up building more houses, and you know that's how markets work. But at the moment, nothing seems to have changed that sort of fundamental fact that the house builders are building enough houses to keep them profitable. And the way to address the supply and demand imbalance would arguably be for the government to build more homes, or for other forms of housing to come to market, or for smaller house builders to build more homes. But it's unlikely that the house builders are going to, in terms of what house prices might mean for them, of course, what it means for the wider public is a different question entirely. I suppose what I'm saying is, even if house prices were to fall, going back to Cress Nicholson, I don't think Cress Nicholson would be too negatively impacted by that. As we were talking about, you know, the cash they're sitting on, their revenue's still growing. I think they could stomach a 1% fall in house prices, because then arguably correspond with a surge in demand. So
yeah, one would hope for a few percentage point fall in house prices shouldn't be too difficult for them, as long as it wasn't sustained over the longer term. But yeah, I suppose we shall see whether that potential value in the sector is going to be unlocked, or if, you know, these concerns continue to override them.
I'm crossing my fingers for a house price fall in Croydon.
Well, yeah, you two on diametrically opposed viewpoints, we'll see what happens there. But again, maybe, you know, the middle ground of, you know, stagnation or sclerosis in the housing market might, you know, mean no one is entirely satisfied, but from a shareholder point of view, maybe that could work out. Okay, now we move on to this week's cover story in your magazines this week. The article is Shares for Safety, written by Julian Hoffman. This is obviously a very timely topic given the serious volatility we've seen again in the past week and over the past months. The article is looking at modern value investing and how it might be able to mitigate risk for investors. Julian, welcome. Can you sort of just outline, I guess, the premise of the piece in a bit more detail and what you were trying to explain to readers with the piece?
Well, thanks very much, Dan. I was trying to update the idea of what value investing is about, or at least trying to get a handle on the discipline. The short answer to that question is that there isn't a lot of new literature on value investing. It sort of relies on a foundation of sort of texts that everybody knows. So it's going to be Benjamin Graham that everyone waves in your face. There was a guy who I found from the early 1990s who'd written a very popular value investing book, but it's almost impossible to get a copy. The cheapest price I could find on Amazon was £2,500, which kind of gives value its own sorts of meaning. But I did speak to Slovenia's most famous value investor called Sven Karlin, who has written a book on modern value investing. And his ideas, I thought, were quite interesting in that the thing that nobody ever really understands about the discipline is what is the margin of safety? I mean, how do you define it as a concept that makes any sense? Because in a sense, one person's risk is another person's, you know, idea of hell, or, you know, one person's idea acceptable risk is someone's idea of something that's completely unacceptable. So what you tend to find is that it's a very subjective narrative when it comes to trying to understand that concept. The easiest definition I could find, which was written by Sven, who we include in the piece in a sort of interview format, is that it's all about understanding value as taking a view of risk that's inverted to the price of the shares. So we usually understand a low PE along with perhaps a higher dividend as a sign of higher risk in a funny sort of way. So investors don't expect much from the shares, so they mark them down. Whereas a new value investor, at least a pure value investor, would actually interpret that as your risk profile being acceptable. So that's essentially, that's how you can see the margin of safety, that it's a way of looking, it's a way of getting away from the pyramid of risk that we tend to associate with modern investing, and actually understanding those PE numbers or those share prices really as a vote of confidence. So you sort of, if you're seeing something with a very high PE, it's not necessarily anything to do with the value that the company is creating so much as how popular that particular company or share is in the market. And it struck me that that was a way of thinking that was far simpler than that rather like the abstract way that Benjamin Graham approaches the topic. And it's never been fully explained. So I think that that's the essence of the article, is to get people to think about the current markets in a way that defines it not being about the value of something, but the risk of owning it. I think that's how the best way of looking at it. And yes, it was a very interesting sort of trawl. And I also got to speak to Slovenia's foremost value investor, which I think not many people can say that.
Yeah, I mean, as we both know, there are so many value investors in Slovenia that are speaking to the foremost is an achievement in itself. We'll come on to that in a minute, because despite my slight sarcasm there, I think Sven Karlin is very very interesting character and has a lot of interesting insights. But I suppose what kind of strikes me is, you know, when we're looking at this, you know, the risk element there, it can be quite counterintuitive for investors, particularly when they think about value investing, because for so long, certainly in recent years as well, we've considered it, you know, from the as a contrarian investing mindset. It's certainly been contrarian in recent years, but also the very idea of buying a lowly valued share. I know that's the, you know, the kind of definition we're trying to get away from a little bit, you know, feels like you're going against the herd, but what we're trying to reframe it almost as is, you know, those are situations where actually the safety being provided is actually quite significant in such cases. You know, that margin of safety
yes.
is significant.
Well, the safety is in the price and not in the earnings. I think that's the key difference in the way of looking at it. Say, if you take it like a relative value investor like Terry Smith, so his spiel is more about the buy-in level that makes sense for his level of risk. But that isn't, you could end up in quite buying things at very high multiples without getting the compensation if there's a massive downturn in tech shares, which is basically what's happened to that style of investing. It is counterintuitive. So you buy something because it's cheaper. And it is plugging into that idea, which actually most of the literature alludes to, is that, you know, that is the idea that the stock market is a voting machine and not a weighing machine. The voting machine is where things get bid up to dizzy levels that don't make any sense from a fundamental point of view. Whereas the weighing machine is the returns that you're going to get over 10, 20 years from something that you haven't paid too much for. And in a sense, we had this discussion today in a moderation I was sharing. You know, if you're a value investor, you don't get rich quickly. I think that's the other point to bear in mind. If you're looking for very quick returns on a few shares, then this isn't the strategy or probably the article for you. I mean, but you know, this is about disciplining your investing life over quite a long time, I would say, and hopefully this article will help people to do that.
I suppose another question that arises from this whole topic is you know, separating out those attractive values from the value traps, you know, trying to avoid that kind of scenario. I mean, is that does the literature say much on that front in terms of, you know, some basic rules to follow there, other than
that's where you're going to look into the balance sheet and the income statement. I think, you know, that's the other side of it, of the coin. Having identified a level of a price level that matches your idea of risk, then you have to then take the risk of doing the research into it. And that's probably where a lot of people just don't bother. They don't look at what the prospects are or what the underlying industry is. I mean, I don't think it's an easy approach. I mean, you could just turn down hundreds of possible, you know, you have to be prepared to turn down hundreds of possible shares in any given period and then just find one or two that would fit that exact criteria that you want. I mean, you just want solid earnings growth over a history of solid earnings growth, and as far as you can project, one that goes out for the next 5 years, and it's not it's far harder than you imagine. I mean, it's not really just a question of turning on a stock screen. It is looking at the annual reports, seeing what the company's doing, understanding a bit about the sector. That is all part of it, and that is, you know, the margin of safety is also the amount of effort you want to put in. I think that could be the key takeaway in. The key takeaway for it.
Yeah, it's you're right. It's, you know, giving you more chance of coming up with something worthwhile from all that effort, which is, you know, that kind of analysis is obviously what we're all about. And I think our readers and listeners too would say likewise. Let's turn to Sven Carlin. You know, you spoke to him, the author of Modern Value Investing. What did you kind of glean from that conversation, you know, from his mindset that was particularly interesting?
Well, I thought the interesting thing I've thought about what he was saying is that his take on it is that you have to be as ecumenical as possible, if that isn't too a religious a term, but you can't allow yourself to be rigidly attached to one part of the market, or even one indices or one equity index. His view is that you have to follow your research and then let your research take you on the, you know, the towards the opportunities you're looking for. in some ways that might be more liberal in a way than traditionally conservative value investing, which tends to base itself within one index quite rigidly. I think there isn't if we're being honest about it, there isn't a broad sense that you would get involved in emerging markets easily, that you would have to have more expertise than might be available to the average retail investor. But Sven's take on it was that you can't let that inhibit you. I think that you should be able to, through your own effort, acquire the knowledge and the expertise in order to rate and assess opportunities wherever they are found. I mean, there has to be a certain amount of open-mindedness about doing that, which I thought was an interesting take, really, because you usually associate that more with perhaps the momentum area, that, you know, momentum investors will generally go wherever the momentum is. But the idea that as a value player, that you could find yourself in, you know, buying shares in Vietnam, for example, or banks in Mongolia. I mean, that's alien, I think, to the sector, and that could be much more interesting if we did apply a more rigorous approach to it, I think.
Yeah, I think you're right. Value is often pigeonholed in an investment style that belongs to just a few sectors. I suppose another example is if you look at some of the value indices in the US, by all accounts, Meta, you know, Facebook is going to be a fairly larger constituent of those at the next reshuffle, which again is quite a counterintuitive, a slightly extreme example there, perhaps. But it just goes to show, I suppose, you can't ever rule anything out from without having done the work to begin with.
And also, you just can't allow yourself to say, well, I'm a value investor, so I'm just going to buy loads of insurance companies that pay 8%. Yields or something. I mean, I don't think that's the point of the discipline. And hopefully the article updates people a bit on how they should be looking at it.
Sure. Well, one thing I was quite interested in when it comes to the analysis that one has to do to, you know, when you're digging into these companies, into the balance sheets, into the potential opportunities, is the world does change the way companies run themselves. Does change too. And one thing you highlighted as something that is shifting on that front and might be of interest to value investors was to do with inventories, which is a subject I'm also potentially looking at this week. So I found that quite interesting.
Yes, well, I found myself going down the rabbit warren of American cement companies during this particular bit of research, which I don't actually mention in the article, but it was actually what inspired me to write about it. It was to look at what effect things like inflation have on inventory and how companies manage it. And there is a certain amount of balance sheet, and manipulation is too strong, but management that you can do in order to counteract the risk. In some ways, you know, inflation is a positive for many people, as long as they can pass along the costs in some way onto the consumer. The way that works with inventory, if you buy in a lot of raw materials at once, it's usually quite sort of like base material companies are great for this. That if they buy in a lot of base materials at one price and inflation goes up next year by 10%, then the value of their underlying inventory goes up by at least 10% without having to spend an additional penny on any more stock. So the weird phenomenon you get with that is that a lot of companies will start over ordering on particular items, particular kinds of, you know, things like cement or, you know, steel. They'll start buying up pallets and pallets of particular base materials and then just have them sitting in warehouses or in the yard somewhere and then revalue them every year on the balance sheet at a higher level. And so there is a win-win that you can do with that. The only problem is that when the market crashes and inflation comes back, goes back down again, or the base materials go back down in value, you could be sitting on a very large paper loss from having played that particular game. But I think we are sort of in that situation, like a bit like in the 1970s, where that period spurred a lot of stocking up of stuff, and that partly you could say that's security against supply chain disruption, but arguably it's also a balance sheet management play that's starting to come in. And some companies have been badly burned by some companies, like, you know, we were talking about Walmart earlier. They've been burned by overstocking on the wrong things, but there are other industries where that is actually a good thing to do in that makes sense in this kind of environment. But and also, I mean, the cost of capital is still low. It's only 2.5. You know, if you're paying 2.5% for 8-year debt or something, then if inflation is going up 9% a year, then the value of your underlying debt is eroding away. I mean, there's no issue with holding debt on your balance sheet.
These are certainly issues to keep a very close eye on, I think, in the months ahead, which we will be doing, and I'm sure our listeners will be as well. Thank you very much for that, Julian. For more on this subject, of course, you can read the full piece in the IC out this week. That does bring us to the end of this week's podcast. Thank you to Julian and to Mitchell and to Alex and John as well. We'll be back next week with another Companies and Markets show. Goodbye.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real frank discussions, talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.